We begin with the death announced officially yesterday of King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, reminding us of one of this country's most important alliances, a relationship that predates NATO and even the creation of the State of Israel.
One of the most colorful visits to the presidential cruiser was that of the ruler of Saudi Arabia, King Ibn Saud.
To the White House comes Crown Prince Faisal of Saudi Arabia at his own request to see President Eisenhower.
President Kennedy pays a courtesy call on the leader of the oil-rich country to wish him a speedy recovery.
I took this action to assist the Saudi Arabian government.
President Bush and Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah holding hands as they stroll.
I want to welcome His Majesty, King Abdullah, to the White House.
Saudi Arabia and the United States, uneasy rivals in the oil business, uneasy partners in Middle East politics. The Saudi royal court announced that King Abdullah died at age 90 today after being admitted to a hospital for a lung infection on December 31st. Abdullah's brother, Crown Prince Salman, announced that he had assumed the throne in a smooth transition of power, a transition that has been coming for some time, according to former U.S. Ambassador James Smith.
King Abdullah has been ill for several years. I will tell you that when I arrived in 2009, people were predicting his ill health 5 years ago. He's outlived two crown princes, and he's been a man of very solid strength. So we knew it was inevitable. Having said that, the Saudi bureaucracy proceeded with him at the helm, and I think if you look at the duties that Crown Prince, now King Salman, has picked up over the last year or two, then it's pretty clear that the Saudis had a transition plan in mind. And for all of those that feared instability as a byproduct of secession were mistaken.
And this is very much a stay the course message, King Salman.
I think it's a stay-the-course message on a trajectory of modernization. You have to understand that this is a very, very conservative society, and you've got about half the population that thinks in terms of a very conservative and going back to the days of the Prophet Muhammad, if you will, and half the population that's looking for modernization and saying that the modernization is painfully slow. So the king has to balance these, and what King Abdullah did so effectively over the last 20 years is balance those constituencies always in a direction of modernization.
But there is another cleavage in Saudi Arabia, and Abdullah has managed to paper over that. But I'm wondering how sustainable the balance is between the sort of proliferating royal family within the bureaucracy and everyone else in Saudi Arabia. The idea that the royal family is perceived as being entitled and on some level a hindrance to real modernization, and that that fuels a kind of instability moving ahead.
It's not there yet, John. Most Saudis are comfortable with the government as it is. Certainly, there has been, we saw this in 2011 with the Arab Spring, voices that wanted to control corruption, that wanted to make sure that monies were flowing to people who are needed, that money was used for development. You hear those kinds of things, but you rarely hear any sense of dissatisfaction with the structure of the government. So, yeah, you have a royal family that's expanding, but the reality of that is there are probably only a very limited number of senior princes that impact the government in a very strong way. So it's a much more complex bureaucracy in society than this binary discussion of the royal family and everybody else.
Ambassador James Smith, before we go, someone today summed up the crisis facing King Salman in Saudi Arabia right now in four words: oil prices, Yemen, Iran. How would you assess that?
Well, that's a start. I think Saudi Arabia is facing a number of crises that go well beyond all of those. If you look at the external threat, their number one concern is Iran. There's no question about that. And number two is to the south and what's going on in Yemen. and their longstanding conflict with the Houthis. Number three, and not far behind, is the border to the north with Daesh, or ISIS, as some people call it, and those fighters coming back home, as they did after Afghanistan. So they've got this challenge internally. Yeah, you have the challenge of revenues, although this is not going to play out in a big way in Saudi Arabia for some years, because they've done a very credible job of building reserves. So they'll be able to ride out oil prices depressed for some time. The real challenge in the midterm, John, is that we have a generation of Saudis, all who have been able to go off to university through the King Abdullah Scholarship Program. It is a program that rivals the GI Bill in terms of its potential impact on that country. If the Saudis are not able to move away from a state-run economy into one that empowers entrepreneurship, small and medium enterprises, and allows for job creation in the private sector, then you're going to have a generation of young people coming home with advanced degrees, unable to find a job, and that's where the frustration will begin in this generation.
Ambassador James Smith, former U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia from 2009 to 2013, thanks so much for joining us.
John, good to be with you.
Let's expand on some of the issues raised by the ambassador with Robert Wirth, longtime foreign correspondent for the New York Times and current fellow at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, Robert.
Thank you.
So when King Abdullah took office, was elevated to king, it was a very different Middle East world, and particularly a world in the Gulf. Now you've really got a rivalry with Iran and this instability in Yemen right on the border. What do you make of all that and how that's going to affect Salman, King Salman's early going here?
Well, the immediate threat is going to be Yemen. The Houthis have been there for some time, and it's interesting that you noted when King Abdullah came to power, they were just really being noticed for the first time. They were formed in the late 90s, mid-90s, but the first war they fought with the Yemeni state was 2004. At the time, they were this small group in a remote part of Yemen. Now they really control the state, and as of yesterday, there is, the president has stepped down. There's no cabinet, no vice president. It's a completely rudderless country, and you have the Houthis who are at war with al-Qaeda and also at war with the remnants of the country's biggest Sunni party, the equivalent of the Muslim Brotherhood. So what's going to happen there is completely unclear. In the meantime, Saudi Arabia has already pulled out most of its aid to Yemen, and Saudi Arabia was the lifeline economically for Yemen because its economy has been a basket case for some time. The trouble, as I see it, is that the transition, granted, is fairly smooth, but there's more to it than just Salman ascending to the throne. His royal court has to be managed. It's not clear whether he'll maintain the same person who really ran the kingdom day to day for King Abdullah, whose name is Khalid Tawajiri, or whether he'll select someone else. And in the meantime, you have a very, very, very pressing situation to the south. And the Saudis have always been the most important external partner for Yemen. So I think they're really going to have to move faster than they usually move on that one.
One more thing on Yemen. Are the Houthis Iranian proxies, or is it too early to say at this point?
I don't think it's fair to call them Iranian proxies. The Houthis modeled themselves heavily on Hezbollah, but not because Hezbollah was giving them any advice. They just looked out and said, look, here's an insurgent movement that has been very successful, and we should take some lessons from them. The Houthis were accused for many years of being Iranian proxies at a time when it certainly was not true. There was very little connection at all with Iran at that time. People make the connection naturally because the Houthis are Zaydis, and Zaydism is a branch of Shiite Islam. But doctrinally, it's actually very far from the mainstream Shiite Islam that's practiced in Iran. However, in recent years, there have been links formed. The Iranians have given some weapons, money, and so forth to the Houthis, even though the Houthis scarcely needed it. They had a lot of weapons of their own, and they proved themselves to be excellent fighters. However, the assistance has expanded quite a bit since 2011, when things became a lot more chaotic in Yemen after the uprising. And now the extent of Iranian Houthi cooperation is really unclear. I think you could certainly say the Houthis are definitely a much more – they're clearly a Yemeni phenomenon. They originated there. Their goals and leadership are unmistakably Yemeni. They're not anywhere near as close to Iran as, for instance, Hezbollah is.
Right, right. Before we go, one other issue. Is this an opportunity for religious forces in Saudi Arabia to make some play politically? It's always been in the background.
I don't think so. The Saudis have been involved in all kinds of ways in Yemen for a long, long time. They dispersed regular payments to all kinds of tribal sheikhs and political figures. And this was done in a very undisciplined, corrupt way where it wasn't clear what was to be given in exchange. Many people in Yemen regard the Saudis just as this sort of big piggy bank and openly mocked them for it. The Saudis, in other words, have the power of the checkbook, but it's not clear what other power they have. Mm-hmm. The Houthis arose in part as a rebellion against Wahhabi influence coming from Saudi Arabia.
Robert Wirth is a contributor to our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much.
A pleasure.